This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Bill Russell, one of the most iconic players in pro basketball history, died Sunday at the age of 88. Russell was a big man who was the game's first noted shot blocker, and his rebounding and passing made him the ultimate team player. He led the Boston Celtics to 8 straight NBA titles, 11 in all in his 13 seasons. He was a 5-time league most valuable player. In 1967, Russell became the NBA's first African-American head coach when he replaced Celtics coach Red Auerbach. Russell served as a player coach for 3 years. Russell had an uneasy relationship with Boston fans. In 1987, his daughter wrote an essay detailing the racism Russell had faced, including racist vandalism visited upon the family home in 1960. Russell refused to sign autographs, and when his number was retired by the team in 1972, he insisted it be at a private ceremony at the Boston Garden. Russell was also active on civil rights issues. He joined the 1963 March on Washington and was in the front row for Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. He went to Mississippi after civil rights leader Medgar Evers was murdered. In 2011, President Barack Obama awarded Russell the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Terry spoke to Bill Russell in 2001 when he'd published a book called Russell Rules, 11 Lessons on Leadership. Russell began by talking about how the Celtics developed defensive skills among their players.
We had a drill that we would put our hands out in front and move them away. Left hand would go left and right hand would go right, and see how far you could take them and still see them, both at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And you see, so that if I'm in the right position using my peripheral vision, about 90% of the time I can see all 10 players and the 2 or 3 referees.
Well, let me put this into play for a second. Say, I mean, you led the NBA in rebounding for several seasons. Say you're getting a ball on the rebound and you're using your peripheral vision to see where the rest of your team is so you can figure out who to tap the ball to. Tell me what's going through your mind, what you're doing physically and mentally on this rebound.
Well, first of all, to get the rebound, I try to get the position before the shot's taken. You see, if you watch a player, you have to count on players being good, first of all. And one of the things that make you good is consistency. So when I say, for example, I see Jerry West setting Casey up to take a jump shot from the right side. Well, I know most of the time if he misses, where the rebound's going to go because he's consistent. I have to count on his greatness. So I start going to where his misses go. Okay, now, when he misses and I get a rebound, I've collaborated with Kuzi or Casey, whoever my point guard is. When the shot's taken, they're to go to an open spot, either on the left side or the right side, which we've talked about before. And so using my peripheral vision as I make sure I got the rebound first, and then I look out of the corner of my eye, and if we're at home, I look for a white uniform in that spot, just the white, the color. Or if we're on the road, I look for the green. And so all I know is I see that green, just the color. I don't have time to focus in so that I see the whole person. And then I just, most of the time before I landed, I would have passed the ball to that uniform. And that would start our fast break. There's only one problem with that, though.
Yeah.
I don't get to shoot very much. Because by the time I get to the top of the key from the defense, Casey or Kuz, they've gotten one of the guys a shot. Because we used to get a shot. When I was having a good rebounding night, defensively, we were shooting most time within 6 seconds. And they didn't wait for me. And every player likes to shoot.
Let's talk a little bit about your approach to blocking your greatest opponent, which was Wilt Chamberlain. He was 5 inches taller than you were. Now, you had the ability to jump. How did you use jumping and anything else that you could do to block Chamberlain?
Well, one of the things that I learned, maybe in high school or in college, that when people shoot jump shots, for example, or most of the shots now, very rarely do people shoot standing still without jumping. Now they shoot, sometimes they shoot a three-pointer without jumping, but most of the shots are jump shots. Well, when you jump to shoot, you cannot jump as high as you can. Because if you do, you won't be able to shoot at the end of the height. Because to see the shot starts in your feet and flows up through your body and leaves on your fingertips. They may sound a little esoteric, but it's the truth. And so most guys that are good jumpers will jump as high as they, maybe as half as high as they can jump when they shoot offensively. Mm-hmm. The defensive player is not under those constraints. He can jump as high as he possibly can because he doesn't have to shoot at the end of the jump. And so when Wilt would take his jump, his fadeaway jump shot, first of all, I was left-handed. And so I didn't have to reach across my body to get to his right hand. So I picked up 3 inches right there. Then I could jump as high as I possibly can. He's limited to how high he can jump. So I pick up another 3 inches. So now I'm up with the ball. Now, but with him, if I did that too often, that would not be an intelligent thing for me to do. Because with all his physical talents, he was also very, very smart. And so if you did something to stop him, what he wanted to do, he would make adjustments. And you did not want him to make an adjustment. So what I would do sometimes is, rather than try to block the shot, is when he's setting up for the shot, push him another 2 inches away from the basket. That changes the angle. It's very, very minute, but it changes the angle. And so he's shooting from a different angle, and that will throw off the shots half of the time. And so he's shooting, and he's making some, and he's missing some, but I want him to have the thought that it's just because he's just shooting, not shooting good, not that I was harassing him. Because I didn't want him to ever think that I was harassing him, because that would not be a good idea.
No, it sounds to me that you take a very analytical approach to the game.
Well, I wouldn't put it all like intelligence. You've got to remember now, this is not rocket science. This is a game that kids play.
In the days when you and Wilt Chamberlain were playing, and part of your job was to prevent him from scoring, could you have become friends with him off the court? I mean, would you ever hang out together, or was it best for you to not really get to know him as a friend and as a person so that you could just be more kind of cold and calculating on the court and not?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, I never tried to stop him from scoring. That would be a bad idea. Because, first of all, I'd be doomed to failure. To stop him from scoring, that wasn't going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
What my ambition was to make him less efficient. Say, if he's got 45 points.
Oh, right. Stop him from scoring as much. Yeah, that's what I meant. Yeah.
If he gets 45 points, if it took him 40 shots, then I've had a good night.
Right.
You understand me?
Yes.
Okay. As for friends, for 5 or 6 years, we had a Thanksgiving night game in Philadelphia at Convention Hall. You know where that is?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In the middle of the afternoon, Wilt would come to the hotel, pick me up, and we'd go to his house. You know, he came from a large family, 6 or 7 kids, you know. And I would have Thanksgiving dinner with his mother and father and his sisters and brothers. And then his mother, bless her, would let me go and get in his bed and take a nap. And then we go to the game and just kick the hell out of each other.
And that was okay, huh? It didn't prevent, it didn't like, inhibit your ability to kick the hell out of him after, you know, his mother made you Thanksgiving dinner?
No, and it didn't bother him either. He didn't mind kicking the hell out of me. In fact, one of those nights he got 55 rebounds.
Right.
Against us. And so he was not inhibited in any way, shape, form, or fashion. Because, you know, when we got on the court, we were determined to outplay each other.
Right.
Now, the outplaying each other was for him to do what he did for his team as well as possible, and for me to do what I did for my team as well as possible, which were two different things. That's why I never, and he agreed, we never considered each other rivals. We considered each other competitors. Because in rivalry, one guy beats the other guy. In competitiveness, we were both enormously successful.
Now, you were Boston's first African-American star athlete, and I think when you joined the Celtics, I think you were the only African-American on the team for a short while. Is that right?
Just for 1 year. You know, what's funny is that with the Celtics,
yeah,
within the organization, that was never an issue.
What about outside the organization in Boston?
Well, at that time in the United States of America, that was very difficult.
What year are we talking? What year did you join?
I joined 56, 57 season.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was like seven years before the first, that 64 Civil Rights Act and before the Brown versus School Board. This is before all those things. And in this country at that time, it was very uncomfortable for African Americans and all walks of life. What made Boston unique was that in Roxbury, over 90% of the African Americans lived within 2 or 3 miles of each other. But that was also true to North End with the Italians. And it's also true in Southie with the Irish Catholics. And then there was Brookline with the Brahmins. And there was a phrase they used to use that the Cabots only talk to the lodges and the lodges only talk to God.
Right.
and then you had the Jewish community. And so all these communities were separate. And they were equally mean to everybody. You know, and so it was like, it was more than just a race thing. It was also a cultural and religious thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so, and I spoke about it, but I'll say this. The only reason I spoke about it in Boston was that's where I was living. You understand? I wasn't in San Francisco talking about Boston. I wasn't in Cleveland talking about Boston. I was in Boston talking about Boston.
Well,
you understand me?
Yeah. Now, what about the fans when you were playing? Did you feel that the fans in Boston were with you, or did you feel that, like, white fans were uncomfortable rooting for a black player?
To a certain degree, and that still exists. What happened is, for example, my second year in the league, I was the most valuable player. And in those days, the MVP was picked by the players. So my peers picked me as the most valuable player in the league. The all-league team was picked by the writers. I was second team all-league. So now, with my peers, I was the best player playing. But with the writers, I was the sixth or seventh best player playing. And so the fans, which quite understandably, they said, that's the way it is, you know. I'd always played to try to win every game because I had found in earlier in my life that these awards and things were extremely political. That's a polite way of saying it. And I would never let people that really don't know what's going on define to me or assign to me a place in history.
Right.
Not that I would accept. You understand me?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so that I have a sense of self that I know what I did, how I did it, and what I accomplished.
Here's a really important question. How do you feel about the longer, baggier shorts that players wear today compared to the shorter, tighter ones that players wore in your day?
Well, see, when we were young and energetic, and the young ladies could see our thighs,
yeah,
we thought that was very attractive. But do you know how the long shorts came to be?
No, I don't.
Well, that's another thing we can thank my good friend, Michael Jordan. What happened was when he went to the Bulls, now this is a story that I've been told. When he went to the Bulls, he was, like all of us, he had some superstitions. So what he did was he wore his North Carolina blue and white shorts under his Bulls shorts. And so every time he'd fall or go do something like that, you could see their blue underneath. Well, from what I hear, the commissioner called and says, hey, listen, that's out of uniform. You cannot have that showing. So rather than stop wearing his shorts, he had his Bulls shorts made longer so they would cover up the blue. And so when Michael starts wearing longer shorts, and Michael was the man. And so everybody started wearing it. Hey, if Michael's wearing them, it's good enough for him. If that works for him, maybe I'll try it. Might help. And so all these guys are getting longer and longer shorts. But they have a limit, you know, on how close they can be to their knees and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's amusing as heck, you know. And then as a, you know, in this culture, we have a hair thing. You know, it's like when Bill Walton was really playing great at Portland, he wore a ponytail and a beard. And people up in arms about that. You know, athletes are not supposed to do that. That's for the hippies, you know. And then when I was a rookie, I hadn't started shaving, so I had a beard. And you have no idea how much conversation about the beard, which had nothing to do with anything. And now these guys are wearing these, they call cornrows. And the white guys can't do that. But when I was playing, a lot of the white guys grew crew cuts. I couldn't do that. And so, you know, it's like, it's just so funny to me when I see things that that people get upset about.
Right, and how things go in and out of fashion.
Yeah, yeah, you know.
Bill Russell, one last question. Can you still jump? Do you have any reason to jump?
I jump with joy sometimes because that's an integral part of my life. One of the first things I remember as a kid was running along and just jumping, just for the joy. I think jumping is really, really, really important part of our psyche. You can jump for many reasons, you know, and this is an expression. And so now I don't try to dunk anymore. I go for more pedestrian type of activities nowadays. So there's a place where if I have to get from one place to the other, I'd rather walk than run. So then when I get there, I can do whatever I want to do
mm-hmm.
instead of having to sit down and rest for 10 minutes.
Yeah, right. Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry Gross, you have no idea what a thrill it is to converse with you.
Hall of Fame basketball player Bill Russell speaking with Terry Gross in 2001. Russell died Sunday at the age of 88.